readers, welcome to the Book Report, and welcome to 2012. I hope you've had a wonderful holiday, enjoyed all your friends, perhaps some football, and got a kick out of reading all those year-in-review lists. One of my favorites, of course, is Dave Barry's year-in-review. Hysterical! Look it up online if you haven't seen it already. But speaking of reviews, as promised, this edition of the Book Report takes one last look at 2011 with a spotlight on the top 20 books of the year. We'll hear audio selections from titles we haven't yet previewed, and I'll let you know where on bookreportradio.com you can sample the rest. I'll also be bringing you an interview from one of the most distinguished authors on that list. So, we've just turned the calendar. Now let's turn to page one of the Book Report.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MAGICBUZ.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Alright, list lovers, here is the first installment of Amazon's Top 20 Books of the Year. As your literary guide, I'm proud to say that after today's show, Book Report Radio will have brought you previews of all 20. Part 1, here goes. Number 1, The Art of Fielding by Chad Harbach. And number 2, 1Q84 by Haruki Murakami. We'll preview both of those next. 3. What It Is Like to Go to War by Carl Marlantis. Look for that one on bookreportradio.com, archived shows, week of October 15th. 4. In the Garden of Beasts by Eric Larson. Find it on archived shows, week of June 25th. The Marriage Plot by Jeffrey Eugenides is number 5, and it's coming right up. Number 6, Daughter of Smoke and Bone by Lainey Taylor. We just previewed that one last week. Number 7, Before I Go to Sleep by S.J. Watson. We'll hear it on this show. Number 8, Steve Jobs by Walter Isaacson. Archived shows, week of December 3rd on bookreportradio.com. Number 9, Lost in Shangri-La by Mitchell Zukov. Take a listen at archived shows, week of October 8th. And number 10, The Tiger's Wife by Thea Obrecht, which we previewed on May 21st, and I spoke with Thea on December 17th. So now, book one on Amazon's list, The Art of Fielding by Chad Harbach. At a small college on the shores of Lake Michigan, baseball star Henry Scrimshander seems destined for the big leagues. As the story unfolds, a routine throw goes disastrously off course, and the fates of 5 people are upended. Henry's fight against self-doubt threatens to ruin his future. The college president, a longtime bachelor, has fallen unexpectedly and hopelessly in love. Henry's gay roommate and teammate becomes caught up in a dangerous affair. The team captain and Henry's best friend realizes he has guided Henry's career at the expense of his own. And the college president's daughter returns after escaping an ill-fated marriage, determined to start a new life. As the season counts down to his climactic final game, these 5 are forced to confront their deepest hopes, anxieties, and secrets. In the process, they forge new bonds and help one another find their true paths. Holter Graham narrates.
Schwartz didn't notice the kid during the game. Or rather, he noticed only what everyone else did, that he was the smallest player on the field, a scrawny novelty of a shortstop. Quick of foot, but weak with the bat. Only after the game ended, when the kid returned the sun-scorched diamond to take extra grounders, did Schwartz see the grace that shaped Henry's every move. This was the second Sunday in August, just before Schwartz's sophomore year at Westish College, that little school in the crook of the baseball glove that is Wisconsin. He'd spent the summer in Chicago, his hometown, and his Legion team had just beaten a bunch of farm boys from South Dakota in the semifinals of a no-name tournament. The few dozen people in the stands clapped mildly as the last out was made. Schwartz, who'd been weak with heat cramps all day, tossed his catcher's mask aside and hazarded a few unsteady steps toward the dugout. Dizzy, he gave up and sank down to the dirt, let his huge, aching back relax against the chain-link fence. It was technically evening, but the sun still beat down wickedly. He'd caught 5 games since Friday night, roasting like a beetle in his black catcher's gear. His teammates slung their gloves into the dugout and headed for the concession stand. The championship game would begin in half an hour. Schwartz hated being the weak one, the one on the verge of passing out, but it couldn't be helped. He'd been pushing himself hard all summer, lifting weights every morning, 10-hour shifts at the foundry, baseball every night, and then this hellish weather. He should have skipped the tournament, varsity football practice at Westish, an infinitely more important endeavor, started tomorrow at dawn, suicide sprints in shorts and pads. He should be napping right now, preserving his knees. But his teammates had begged him to stick around. Now he was stuck at this ramshackle ballpark between a junkyard and an adult bookstore on the interstate outside Peoria. If he were smart, he'd skip the championship game, drive the 5 hours north to campus, check himself into student health for an IV and a little sleep. The thought of Westish soothed him. He closed his eyes and tried to summon his strength. When he opened his eyes, the South Dakota shortstop was jogging back onto the field. As the kid crossed the pitcher's mound, he peeled off his uniform jersey and tossed it aside. He wore a sleeveless white undershirt, had an impossibly concave chest, and a fierce farmer's burn. His arms were as big around as Schwartz's thumbs. He'd swapped his green Legion cap for a faded red St. Louis Cardinals one. Shaggy, dust-blonde curls poked out beneath. He looked 14, 15 at most, though the tournament minimum was 17. During the game, Schwartz had figured the kid was too small to hit high heat, so he'd called for one fastball after another, up and in. Before the last, he told the kid what was coming and added, "Since you can't hit it anyway." The kid swung and missed, gritted his teeth, turned to make the long walk back to the dugout. Just then Schwartz said, ever so softly, so that it would seem to come from inside the kid's own skull. The kid paused, his scrawny shoulders tensed like a cat's, but he didn't turn around. Nobody ever did. Now when the kid reached the worked-over dust that marked the shortstop spot, he stopped, bouncing on his toes and jangling his limbs as if he needed to get loose. He bobbed and shimmied, windmilled his arms, burning off energy he shouldn't have had. He'd played as many games in this brutal heat as Schwartz. Moments later, the South Dakota coach strolled onto the field with a bat in one hand and a 5-gallon paint bucket in the other. He set the bucket beside home plate and idly chopped at the air with the bat. Another of the South Dakota players trudged out to first base, carrying an identical bucket and yawning sullenly. The coach reached into his bucket, plucked out a ball, and showed it to the shortstop, who nodded and dropped into a shallow crouch, his hands poised just above the dirt. The kid glided in front of the first grounder, accepted the ball into his glove with a lazy grace, pivoted, and threw to first. Though his motion was languid, the ball seemed to explode off his fingertips, to gather speed as it crossed the diamond. It smacked the pocket of the first baseman's glove with the sound of a gun going off.
That was The Art of Fielding by Chad Harbach. In Tokyo in 1984, a young woman named Aomame follows a taxi driver's enigmatic suggestion and begins to notice puzzling discrepancies in the world around her. She has entered, she realizes, a parallel existence, which she calls 1Q84. The Q is for question mark. Meanwhile, Tengo, an aspiring writer, takes on a suspect ghostwriting project. He becomes so wrapped up with the work and its unusual author that soon his previously placid life begins to become unraveled. As Aomami and Tengo's narratives converge over the course of this single year, we learn of the profound and tangled connections that bind them ever closer. A love story, a mystery, a fantasy, a novel of self-discovery, and a story to rival George Orwell's, 1Q84 is performed by Allison Hiroto, Mark Vider, and Mark Boyette.
Reaching the turnout, Aomami stopped and looked around. It took only a moment for her to find the emergency stairway. As the driver had said, there was a metal barrier across the entrance. It was a little more than waist-high, and it was locked. Stepping over it in a tight miniskirt could be a slight problem, but only if she cared about being seen. Without hesitating, she slipped her high heels off and shoved them into her shoulder bag. She would probably ruin her stockings by walking in bare feet, but she could easily buy another pair. People stared at her in silence as she removed her shoes and coat. From the open window of the black Toyota Celica parked next to the turnout, Michael Jackson's high-pitched voice provided her with background music. Billie Jean was playing. She felt as if she were performing a striptease. So what? Let them look all they want. They must be bored waiting for the traffic jam to end. Sorry, though, folks. This is all I'll be taking off today. Aomami slung the bag across her chest to keep it from falling. Some distance away, she could see the brand new black Toyota Crown Royal Saloon in which she had been riding, its windshield reflecting the blinding glare of the afternoon sun. She could not make out the face of the driver, but she knew he must be watching. Don't let appearances fool you. There's always only one reality. Aomami took in a long, deep breath and slowly let it out. Then, to the tune of Billie Jean, she swung her leg over the metal barrier. Her miniskirt rode up to her hips. Who gives a d-? Let them look all they want. Seeing what's under my skirt doesn't let them really see me as a person. Besides, her legs were the part of her body of which Aomami was the most proud. Stepping down once she was on the other side of the barrier, Aomami straightened her skirt, brushed the dust from her hands, put her coat back on, slung her bag across her chest again, and pushed her sunglasses more snugly against her face. The emergency stairway lay before her, a metal stairway painted gray. Plain, practical, functional. Not made for use by mini-skirted women wearing only stockings on their otherwise bare feet. Nor had Junko Shimada designed Aomami's suit for use on the emergency escape stairs of Tokyo Metropolitan Expressway No. 3. Another huge truck roared down the outbound side of the expressway, shaking the stairs. The breeze whistled through gaps in the stairway's metal framework. But in any case, there it was before her, the stairway. All that was left for her to do was climb down to the street. Aomami turned for one last look at the double line of cars packed on the expressway, scanning them from left to right, then right to left, like a speaker on a podium looking for questions from the audience now that she had finished her talk. There had been no movement at all. Trapped on the expressway with nothing else to occupy them, people were watching her every move, wondering what this woman on the far side of the barrier would do next. Aomami lightly pulled in her chin, bit her lower lip, and took stock of her audience through the dark green lenses of her sunglasses. You couldn't begin to imagine who I am, where I'm going, or what I'm about to do, Aomami said to her audience without moving her lips. All of you are trapped here. You can't go anywhere, forward or back. But I'm not like you. I have work to do, I have a mission to accomplish, and so, with your permission, I shall move ahead.
That was 1Q84 by Haruki Murakami. My colleague, Terry Thorsbecken, helped me out with my jam-packed interview schedule at the Miami International Book Fair. Here, Terry speaks with Jeffrey Eugenides.
Thank you for taking the time to speak with us today. I've read about the omens you experienced while writing Middlesex. Did you receive any omens during the process of writing the marriage plot?
Unfortunately, I did not have any omens for this book. Middlesex was a book partially about a very superstitious old lady, so I think it almost went with the material that strange things should happen to its author. But the marriage plot is more realistic, and my life was more realistic in not having any kind of strange coincidence or omen happen to me during the composition.
You set the marriage plot in the 1980s. Is the concept of the deconstruction of the notion of love time or generation sensitive?
I don't think so, but the book started for me with a sentence. Madeline's love troubles had begun at the time when the French theory she was reading deconstructed the very notion of love. And as soon as I wrote that line, I was back in the 80s, back in college, and I started to remember, the heyday of deconstruction when everyone was debating it. So I think the ideas are still lingering, but that was a certain point when they were really at a fever pitch.
Madeline is your main character in the marriage plot. Is the process of writing about the thoughts and feelings of women characters more difficult for you than writing about a man's innermost thoughts?
I usually try to distract myself from the fact that I'm writing about a woman. I just think I'm writing about a person. Who is this person? What is she like? What are her likes and dislikes? What is her family like? And I don't think all the time that I'm writing about women or a woman. So that keeps me from any kind of anxiety crippling my progress. I don't find it harder than writing about male characters.
Would your wife agree with that?
Would my wife agree? My wife would not agree with me saying anything about my wife in an interview. That's what I know for sure. So I'll pass on that one.
Interesting. I think I've read a little bit about that. Based on the success of the marriage plot, do you have any plans to come back to any of your other abandoned novels? And does your growth as a writer make you see the characters and stories you abandoned in a different light?
Well, I have a number of abandoned novels, most of them abandoned for good reason. I'm not sure that I'll go back to them. The novel that I had to abandon in order to write the marriage plot, I was quite sure at that time that I would go back when I finished the marriage plot and finished that. I'd worked 2 or 3 years on it before I had to put it away, and the only way I could keep from committing suicide when I actually put it in my drawer was to tell myself, well, I can finish it later. Now, however, having finished the marriage plot, I feel like I've moved on to different interests. That book feels a little bit insular to me, and I don't think I'll go back to it. You never know what I'll do in my dotage, but I think that those stillbirths are definitely gone at this point. I'll move on to something new.
Your publisher seems to wish you would sometimes write faster, but actually also write a little bit more. Have you thought about conferring with your fellow professor Joyce Carol Oates on that?
My publisher has actually never told me to write faster. Very patient publisher that I have, perhaps too patient. I work with Joyce Carol Oates and Edmund White, who's also quite prolific. So I'm hoping that it will rub off on me little by little. I have a book of short stories almost finished now, so my next book will be coming out in a more timely fashion than The Marriage Plot. And yes, of course I would. You know, time's winged chariot is hurrying near. I can hear it, and I would like to publish more often. But the thing I would never do is publish a book just because I think I need to publish something. If I don't have a book that I think is worth people's time, then I don't publish it, because people have a lot of things to read and to do, and I have to wait until my work seems ready and is finished as best I can before I'll publish it. So in a certain way, it's out of my hands. I do work a lot. I write every day, maybe I'm getting the hang of it little by little, and I'll publish more often. But I don't think I'll ever be an Updike or a Joyce Carol Oates.
Is there anything else you'd like to add or tell us today?
Well, it's considering the fact that I went to bed at 2 a.m. and it's now about 9 a.m., I think I've been doing well, just to tell you what I've told you already. But
now, let's listen to an audio sample of The Marriage Plot.
But this son, the one over Providence, was doing the metaphorical son one better, because the founders of the university, in their Baptist pessimism, had chosen to depict the light of knowledge enshrouded by clouds, indicating that ignorance had not yet been dispelled from the human realm, whereas the actual sun was just now fighting its way through cloud cover, sending down splintered beams of light and giving hope to the squadrons of parents who'd been soaked and frozen all weekend, that the unseasonable weather might not ruin the day's festivities. All over College Hill, in the geometric gardens of the Georgian mansions, the magnolia-scented front yards of Victorians, along brick sidewalks running past black iron fences like those in a Charles Adams cartoon or a Lovecraft story, outside the art studios at the Rhode Island School of Design, where one painting major, having stayed up all night to work, was blaring Patti Smith, shining off the instruments, tuba and trumpet, respectively, of the two members of the Brown Marching Band, who had arrived early at the meeting point and were nervously looking around, wondering where everyone else was, brightening the cobblestone side streets that led downhill to the polluted river. The sun was shining on every brass doorknob, insect wing, and blade of grass. And, in concert with the suddenly flooding light, like a starting gun for all the activity, the doorbell in Madeline's fourth-floor apartment began, clamorously, insistently, to ring. The pulse reached her less as a sound than as a sensation, an electric shock shooting up her spine. In one motion, Madeline tore the pillow off her head and sat up in bed. She knew who was ringing the buzzer. It was her parents. She'd agreed to meet Alton and Phyllida for breakfast at 7:30. She'd made this plan with them 2 months ago in April, and now here they were, at the appointed time, in their eager, dependable way. That Alton and Phyllida had driven up from New Jersey to see her graduate, that what they were here to celebrate today wasn't only her achievement, but their own as parents, had nothing wrong or unexpected about it. The problem was that Madeline, for the first time in her life, wanted no part of it. She wasn't proud of herself. She was in no mood to celebrate. She'd lost faith in the significance of the day and what the day represented. She considered not answering, but she knew that if she didn't answer, one of her roommates would, and then she'd have to explain where she'd disappeared to last night and with whom. Therefore, Madeline slid out of the bed and reluctantly stood up. This seemed to go well for a moment, standing up. Her head felt curiously light, as if hollowed out. But then the blood, draining from her skull like sand from an hourglass, hit a bottleneck, and the back of her head exploded in pain. In the midst of this barrage, like the furious core from which it emanated, the buzzer erupted again. She came out of her bedroom and stumbled in bare feet to the intercom in the hall, slapping the speak button to silence the buzzer.
Hello?
What's the matter? Didn't you hear the bell? It was Alton's voice, as deep and commanding as ever, despite the fact that it was issuing from a tiny speaker.
Sorry, Madeline said. I was in the shower.
Likely story. Will you let us in, please?
Madeline didn't want to. She needed to wash up first. I'm coming down, she said.
This time she held the speak button too long, cutting off Alton's response. She pressed it again and said,
Daddy?
But while she was speaking, Alton must have been speaking too, because when she pressed listen, all that came through was static. Madeline took this pause in communications to lean her forehead against the doorframe. The wood felt nice and cool. The thought struck her that if she could keep her face pressed against the soothing wood, she might be able to cure her headache, and if she could keep her forehead pressed against the doorframe for the rest of the day, while somehow still being able to leave the apartment, she might make it through breakfast with her parents, march in the commencement procession, get a diploma, and graduate. She lifted her face and pressed speak again.
Daddy?
But it was Phyllida's voice that answered.
Maddie? What's the matter? Let us in.
My roommates are still asleep. I'm coming down. Don't ring the bell anymore. We want to see your apartment.
We've just heard The Marriage Plot by Jeffrey Eugenides. Continuing on with the best of 2011, number 11, The Night Circus by Aaron Morgenstern, previewed on BookReportRadio.com archived shows October 29th. Number 12, Bossy Pants by Tina Fey. Find it on archived shows May 14th. Number 13, Blood, Bones, and Butter by Chef Gabrielle Hamilton. We sliced into that one on June 11th. Number 14, We the Animals by Justin Torres, just ahead. Number 15, Moonwalking with Einstein by Joshua Foer, previewed on August 13th. Number 16, The Lover's Dictionary by David Levithan, coming right up. Number 17, The Greater Journey by David McCullough. Find it on BookReportRadio.com, archived shows for June 4th. Number 18, Lost Memory of Skin by Russell Banks. I interviewed the author and previewed the book on October 22nd. Number 19, Maphead by Ken Jennings. Look for it on archived shows, BookReportRadio.com, November 5th. And last, number 20, The Sisters Brothers by Patrick DeWitt, previewed on July 2nd. Quote, as I sleep, my mind will erase everything I did today. I will wake up tomorrow as I did this morning, thinking I'm still a child, thinking I have a whole lifetime of choice ahead of me. Unquote. Welcome to Christine's life. Memories define us. In Before I Go to Sleep, S.J. Watson explores what happens if you lose your memory every time you go to sleep. What if your name, your identity, your past, even the people you love are forgotten each night? Orla Cassidy narrates.
The skin on the cheeks and under the chin sags. The lips are thin. The mouth turned down. I cry out, a wordless gasp that would turn into a shriek of shock were I to let it, and then notice the eyes. The skin around them is lined, yes, but despite everything else, I can see that they are mine. The person in the mirror is me, but I am 20 years too old. 25. More. This isn't possible. I begin to shake and grip the edge of the sink. Another scream begins to rise in my chest, and this one erupts as a strangled gasp. I step back, away from the mirror, and it is then that I see them. Photographs, taped to the wall, to the mirror itself. Pictures interspersed with yellow pieces of gummed paper, felt-tipped notes, damp and curling. I choose one at random. Christine, it says, and an arrow points to a photograph of me, this new me, this old me, in which I am sitting on a bench on the side of a quay next to a man. The name seems familiar, but only distantly so, as if I am having to make an effort to believe that it is mine. In the photograph, we are both smiling at the camera, holding hands. He is handsome, attractive, and when I look closely, I can see that it is the same man I slept with, the one I left in the bed. The word Ben is written beneath it, and next to it, your husband. I gasp and rip it off the wall. No, I think. No, it cannot be. I scan the rest of the pictures. They are all of me and him. In one, I am wearing an ugly dress and unwrapping a present. In another, both of us wear matching weatherproof jackets and stand in front of a waterfall as a small dog sniffs at our feet. Next to it is a picture of me sitting beside him, sipping a glass of orange juice, wearing the dressing gown I have seen in the bedroom next door. I step back farther, until I feel cold tiles against my back. It is then I get the glimmer that I associate with memory. As my mind tries to settle on it, it flutters away like ashes caught in a breeze, and I realize that in my life there is a then, a before, though before what I cannot say, and there is a now, and there is nothing between the two but a long, silent emptiness that has led me here to me and him. In this house. I go back into the bedroom. I still have the picture in my hand, the one of me and the man I had woken up with, and I hold it in front of me. What's going on? I say. I am screaming, tears run down my face. The man is sitting up in bed, his eyes half closed, Who are you?
I'm your husband, he says.
His face is sleepy, without a trace of annoyance. He does not look at my naked body.
We've been married for years.
What do you mean? I say. I want to run, but there is nowhere to go. Married for years? What do you mean? He stands up.
Here,
he says, and passes me the dressing gown, waiting while I put it on. He is wearing pajama trousers that are too big for him, a white t-shirt. He reminds me of my father.
We got married in 1985, he says. 22 years ago. You...
What? I feel the blood drain from my face, the room begin to spin. A clock ticks somewhere in the house, and it sounds as loud as a hammer. But... He takes a step toward me. How?
Christine, you're 47 now, he says.
I look at him, this stranger who is smiling at me. I don't want to believe him. Don't want to even hear what he is saying, but he carries on.
You had an accident, he says. A bad accident. You suffered head injuries. You have problems remembering things.
What things? I say, meaning surely not the last 25 years. What things? He steps toward me again, approaching me as if I am a frightened animal.
Everything, he says. Sometimes starting from your early 20s. Sometimes even earlier than that.
My mind spins, whirring with dates and ages. I don't want to ask, but know that I must.
That was Before I Go to Sleep by S.J. Watson. Three brothers tear their way through childhood, smashing tomatoes over each other, building kites from trash, hiding out when their parents do battle, tiptoeing around their house as their mother sleeps off her graveyard shift. Paps and Ma are from Brooklyn. He's Puerto Rican, she's white, and their love is a serious, dangerous thing that makes and unmakes a family. Justin Torres in We the Animals portrays life in this family as full of chaos and heartbreak and the euphoria of belonging completely to one another. Frankie J. Alvarez narrates this beautifully written debut novel.
Now a boy is of all wild beasts the most difficult to manage, for by how much the more he has the fountain of prudence not yet fitted up, he becomes crafty and keen, and the most insolent of wild beasts. On this account, it is necessary to bind him, as it were, with many chains. Plato, The Laws. We wanted more. We wanted more. We knocked the butt ends of our forks against the table, tapped our spoons against our empty bowls. We were hungry. We wanted more volume, more riots. We turned up the knob on the TV until our ears ached with the shouts of angry men. We wanted more music on the radio. We wanted beats. We wanted rock. We wanted muscles on our skinny arms. We had bird bones, hollow and light, and we wanted more density, more weight. We were six snatching hands, six stomping feet. We were brothers, boys, three little kings locked in a feud for more. When it was cold, we fought over blankets until the cloth tore down the middle. When it was really cold, when our breath came out in frosty clouds, Manny crawled into bed with Joel and me. Body heat, he said. Body heat, we agreed. We wanted more flesh, more blood, more warmth. When we fought with boots and garage tools, snapping pliers. We grabbed at whatever was nearest and we hurled it through the air. We wanted more broken dishes, more shattered glass. We wanted more crashes. And when our paps came home, we got spankings. Our little round butt cheeks were tore up, red, raw, leather-whipped. We knew there was something on the other side of pain, on the other side of the sting. Prickly heat radiated upward from our thighs and backsides. Fire consumed our brains. But we knew that there was something more, some place our paps was taking us with all this. We knew because he was meticulous, because he was precise, because he took his time. He was awakening us. He was leading us somewhere beyond burning and ripping, and you couldn't get there in a hurry. And when our father was gone, we wanted to be fathers. We hunted animals. We drudged through the muck of the creek, chasing down bullfrogs and water snakes. We plucked the baby robins from their nest. We liked to feel the beat of tiny hearts, the struggle of tiny wings. We brought their tiny animal faces close to ours. "Who's your daddy?" we said. Then we laughed and tossed them into a shoebox. Always more. Always hungrily scratching for more. But there were times, quiet moments, when our mother was sleeping, when she hadn't slept in 2 days, and any noise, any stair creak, any shut door, any stifled laugh, any voice at all might wake her. Those still, crystal mornings, when we wanted to protect her, this confused goose of a woman. This stumbler, this gusher, with her backaches and headaches and her tired, tired ways, this uprooted Brooklyn creature, this tough talker, always with tears when she told us she loved us, her mixed-up love, her needy love, her warmth. Those mornings when sunlight found the cracks in our blinds and laid itself down in crisp strips on our carpet. Those quiet mornings when we'd fix ourselves oatmeal and sprawl onto our stomachs with crayons and paper, with glass marbles that we were careful not to rattle. When our mother was sleeping, when the air did not smell like sweat or breath or mold, when the air was still and light. Those mornings when silence was our secret game and our gift and our sole accomplishment. We wanted less. Less weight, less work, less noise, less father, less muscles and skin and hair. We wanted nothing. Just this. Just this.
That was We the Animals by Justin Torres.
Social media. It's got everyone buzzing these days. But what is it really? And how can you put it to work for you? More than just a passing trend that's hot today, gone tomorrow. Social media is marketing that is making a difference for savvy business people who have jumped into the future. Magic Buzz is a new online marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media like Facebook and Twitter together with the viral reach power of YouTube to create the socio-viral effect. Magic Buzz's socio-viral solution provides the measurable value of online advertising that works, affordable, and effective. So get the buzz going for your business. Magic Buzz, with only one Z, because we're never asleep. Visit us at magicbuz.com. For more information or any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
All beginners when it comes to love, from those tentative first dates to learning how to live with or without someone. But how does one describe love? How does one chart its delights and pleasures, its depths and desolations? Do we have the right words to describe something that can be both utterly mundane and completely transcendent, pulling us out of our everyday lives and making us feel a part of something greater than ourselves? David Levithan's The Lover's Dictionary starts where we once all started, with the alphabet. Constructing the story of a relationship as a dictionary, David explores the intimacies and workings of love through his nameless narrator and paints a moving portrait of love through everyday words. Jot Davies, Cassandra Harwood narrate.
In the long view, did it matter that we shared this? Did it matter that we both drank coffee at night and both happened to go to Barcelona the summer after our senior year? In the long view, was it such a revelation that we were both ticklish and that we both liked dogs more than cats? Really, weren't these facts just placeholders until the long view could truly assert itself? We were painting by numbers, starting with the greens, because that happened to be our favorite color. And this, we figured, had to mean something. Al fresco. Adverb. We couldn't stand the city 1 minute longer, so we walked right into the rent-a-car place, no reservation, and started our journey upstate. As you drove, I called around and eventually I found us a cabin. We stopped at a supermarket and bought a week's worth of food for two nights. It wasn't too cold out, so we moved the kitchen table outside. The breeze kept blowing out the candles. But that didn't matter, because for the first time in our relationship, there were plenty of stars above us. The wine set the tone of our conversation. Languid, tipsy, earthy. "I love dining al fresco," you said, and I laughed a little. "What?" you asked, and I said, "We're not naked, silly." Now it was your turn to laugh. "That's not what it means," you told me. "And anyway, don't you feel naked now?" You fell quiet, gestured for me to listen. The sound of the woods, the feel of the air, the wine settling in my thoughts. The sky so present, and you watching me take it all in. Naked to the world naked to us.
Aloof, adjective. It has always been my habit, ever since junior high school, to ask that question, "What are you thinking?" It is always an act of desperation, and I keep on asking, even though I know it will never work the way I want it to.
Anachronism. Noun. "I'll go get the horse and buggy," you'll say. And I'll say, "But I thought we were taking the hovercraft."
Anthem. Noun. It was our sixth, maybe seventh date. I had cooked and you had insisted on doing the dishes. You wouldn't even let me dry. Then, when you were done, smelling of suds, you sat back down and I poured you another glass of cheapish wine. You put your legs in my lap and slouched, as if we'd just had a feast for thousands and you'd been the only chambermaid on duty to clean it up. There was a pause. I was still scared by every gap in our conversation, fearing that this was it, the point where we had nothing left to say. I was still trying to impress you, and I still wanted to be impressed by you, so I could pass along pieces of your impressiveness in stories to my friends, convincing myself this was possible. "If you were a country," I said, "what would your national anthem be?" I meant a pre-existing song, "What a Wonderful World," or "Que Sera Sera," or something to make it a joke like, "Hey, ya." I would like, more than anything else, for my nation to be shaken like a Polaroid picture. But instead, you said, "It would have to be a blues song." And then you looked up at the ceiling, closed your eyes, and began to sing a blues riff.
Na-na-na-na, my work makes me tired. Na-na-na-na, but I gotta pay my rent. Na-na-na-na, my parents never loved me. Na-na-na-na, left all my emotions bent. Na-na-na-na, I know what I'm here for. Na-na-na-na, make your dishes so clean. Na-na-na-na, just be careful what you wish for. Na-na-na-na, 'cause most my is unseen. Na-na-na-na, so many men. Na-na-na-na, fall into my trap. Na-na-na-na, but boy, I gotta tell ya. Na-na-na-na, you might rewrite that map. Na-na-na-na, because I'm a proud nation. Na-na-na-na, it's written here on my flag. Na-na-na-na, it's a f***ed up world, boy. Na-na-na-na, so you better make me laugh.
That was The Lover's Dictionary by David Levithan.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign, at a fraction of the cost. put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MAGICBUZ.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Michael Andaje was born in Colombo, Sri Lanka, then Ceylon, in 1943. Very much like the main character of The Cat's Table, his newest book, he was sent to England on a ship by himself in 1954. Michael then followed his brother to Canada in 62. He received his MA from Queen's University, Ontario, and began teaching at the University of Western Ontario. In 1970, he settled in Toronto, and from 71 to 1990, taught English Lit at York University and Clendon College. Welcome, Michael. Thanks so much for stopping by the Book Report.
Thank you.
How did you come to the title, The Cat's Table?
Well, it's a term, actually it's a German term for any table or big banquet where the least significant people sit. So if you're at some banquet and you're by the kitchens, then you're at the cat's table. So it's, I thought it fit in quite well with this book, where all the kind of insignificance and minor characters, you know, were always major characters in a way, that they were sitting at this table instead of the captain's table, which is always the posh one.
This story is a rite of passage about a boy aboard ship. How autobiographical is the work?
It's autobiographical in the sense that I did take a trip like this in the 1950s as an 11-year-old boy who had no kind of family with me. So I was kind of completely free and dangerously free. So that was autobiographical. And so that, you know, I didn't remember that journey at all very much, but I thought the idea of a boy on a ship alone at a kind of crucial point in his life going to England was a kind of, could be a fascinating adventure where he and his friends could all get into trouble constantly. So I thought that's how the book began.
Aboard ship, the boy describes himself as being free of the realities of Earth. How did you come up with that wonderful phrase?
Well, I mean, a ship, you're free of the realities of Earth, you know, and it is a kind of that, those rites of passage are times when you are away from society, the society that you know. And I'm always interested in those historical stages, like even in the Second World War, where you are an American or a Canadian and you suddenly end up in Italy. And so that much of The English Patient was really a story about being free of the, you know, responsibilities of where you come from and where you normally live. And that allows you to kind of grow in a different kind of way, in a different kind of pace to the way we do it normally on a day-to-day basis.
The three boys had a rule during the voyage: do one forbidden thing each day. What a wonderful concept. Don't you wish we could apply it to all of our lives?
Well, I think some people still do, actually. But we don't often get the chance.
Yep. I love your line, "Who realizes how contented feral children are?" With a line like that, is it something that you think of and save it for the right moment in your writing, or does it just flow?
You know, remarks like that actually just, they come out of the actual situation of the paragraph and the story. You know, I mean, when you're writing, you're also thinking. I mean, you don't really, when you're writing, you don't have a kind of hoard of phrases that you're in your pocket, you know, that you want to use at a certain time. So they grow really out of the situation. You know, the boy's alone, he's looking, it's his day free with his, away from his family, and, you know, that's how that phrase comes up.
At the dining table, the cat's table, Michael shares his meals with two other boys and several adults, including a botanist, a tailor, a pianist, and a retired ship dismantler. How did you choose those characters?
I'm not quite sure. You know, I mean, it was just a table, and I didn't kind of have them all at the same time. I began with the ship dismantler because I thought, you know, he was interesting to the kids, and he was quite shy. Whereas Mr. Mazzappa, who's the pianist, is much more gregarious and, you know, pushy. So they get to know him quite easily. But, you know, so it's a very gradual thing where those characters at the cat's table, you know, link up with the boys. They have to be ready for that person, you know. It is a kind of education. So Miss Laskiti, who is a strange woman who maybe works for the British Secret Service, you know, is very, very shy and seemingly like a wallflower, you know, and then gradually she becomes more and more important. Whereas Zappa kind of jumps in right away and tells them all rude jokes and so forth.
The prisoner is a haunting character. How did you come to include him, and what does he signify, actually?
I'm not sure what he signifies. I mean, he kind of came out of the blue, you know. I'm always waiting for things to happen in my novels, you know, and I think he came out of a paragraph where I was saying, after the dancing, after the men were cleaning up the floors, they brought out the prisoner, and bang, suddenly I've got a prisoner on my hands, you know. And I guess you're also waiting for people like that to turn up and to kind of complicate the plot. And So it's really a story where it's like a kind of a French farce, you know, where you've got many people coming in and out of doors and so forth. It's a very contained location. So that, you know, you suddenly discover someone, a fragment of somebody, and then you discover more and more and more of that person as the novel progresses.
Every book club in the United States read The English Patient, and I know The Cat's Table is also on that must-read list. Do readers actually reach out to you and make comments, and are you kind of blown away by how they might interpret certain things?
Well, I mean, I'm also a reader, so I interpret things very strangely, perhaps, you know. So, you know, I think D.H. Lawrence says, never trust the teller, trust the tale, you know. So who knows, you know, what's really going on in the novel, but the writer thinks he or she does, you know. Yeah, I mean, I am blown away. I mean, I'm blown away by the fact that, you know, people are interested in reading the book. You know, you never know how a book is going to be taken. You know, you don't, when you're writing, you don't think this is going to be very good or very bad. You just want to save the book, you know, that when you're writing it. That's the main concern. So when a book takes off, it's kind of great and also a bit surreal.
Your books are so atmospheric and so evocative of a time and a place. How much of that is from the oral tradition of your native Ceylon, Sri Lanka?
It might be. I mean, I with that oral tradition that I grew up with, I certainly would be influenced by how people spoke and so forth. But I think when I'm writing, it's much, much more private and intimate thing. That you're writing, you know, I'm in a room alone and I'm trying to build up a scenario or a scene or a set, you know, or a location. So I want to see it. So when I write it, I'm really painting it or drawing it for the reader, you know. This is what the room is like. There's a fridge over here and there's no carpet and there's one painting. And so as you write, you kind of build up that, you know, location as much as you can. And then people walk in and they cause trouble and they leave and all that stuff. So it's a very intimate thing. It's not too much to do with an oral tradition, I don't think.
Is the book really a rite of passage, and is that what you want people to take away from it?
Well, I would hate to limit it to just one thing, I guess. You know, I mean, it's about everything. It's about at a certain point in life when anyone gets educated, you know, unofficially, you know, which is what happens in this book, I guess. But it's about everything, you know, and I don't kind of limit myself to say there's only one theme, you know. There are many, many things happening in the book, and, you know, it's an adventure story for boys, and it's also a very plaintive story about an orphan-like sense in the narrator. And it's about the kind of vividness of characters around you in your life, you know. So it is that adventure. It is a kind of drama that kind of, you know, hopefully will entertain as well as, you know, make people sad or miserable or happy, whatever it is.
Are you already working on your next project?
No, not at all. Not doing nothing right now.
That's a wonderful thing because your book tour is very big.
Yeah, I'm just loafing around.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
You.
The book is worth every single moment of your time.
Thank you very much.
Michael is a poet, publishing 13 books of poetry, and of course, he is a novelist. His books include Coming Through Slaughter, In the Skin of a Lion, The English Patient, which won the Booker Prize and won the Academy Award for Best Picture, Anil's Ghost, Divisadero, and now The Cat's Table. The book is an end-of-empire adventure story about a boy's life-changing journey from Ceylon to England in the early 1950s.
And this is how I see the East. I see it always from a small boat. Not a light, not a stir, not a sound. We conversed in low whispers, as if afraid to wake up the land. It is all in that moment when I opened my young eyes on it. I came upon it from a tussle with the sea. Joseph Conrad, Youth. He wasn't talking. He was looking from the window of the car all the way. Two adults in the front seat spoke quietly under their breath. He could have listened if he wanted to, but he didn't. For a while, at the section of the road where the river sometimes flooded, he could hear the spray of water at the wheels. They entered the fort, and the car slipped silently past the post office building and the clock tower. At this hour of the night, there was barely any traffic in Colombo. They drove out along Reclamation Road, past St. Anthony's Church, and after that he saw the last of the food stalls, each lit with a single bulb. Then they entered a vast open space that was the harbor, with only a string of lights in the distance along the pier. He got out and stood by the warmth of the car. He could hear the stray dogs that lived on the quays barking out of the darkness. Nearly everything around him was invisible, save for what could be seen under the spray of a few sulfur lanterns. Watersiders pulling a procession of baggage wagons. Some families huddled together. They were all beginning to walk towards the ship. He was 11 years old that night when, green as he could be about the world, he climbed aboard the first and only ship of his life. It felt as if a city had been added to the coast, better lit than any town or village. He went up the gangplank, watching only the path of his feet. Nothing ahead of him existed, and continued till he faced the dark harbor and the sea. There were outlines of other ships farther out, beginning to turn on lights. He stood alone, smelling everything, then came back through the noise and the crowd to the side that faced land, a yellow glow over the city. Already it felt there was a wall between him and what took place there. Stewards began handing out food and cordials. He ate several sandwiches, and after that he made his way down to his cabin, undressed, and slipped into the narrow bunk. He'd never slept under a blanket before, save once in Norelia. He was wide awake. The cabin was below the level of the waves, so there was no porthole. He found a switch beside the bed, and when he pressed it, his head and pillow were suddenly lit by a cone of light. He did not go back up on deck for a last look, or to wave at his relatives who had brought him to the harbor. He could hear singing and imagine the slow and then eager parting of families taking place in the thrilling night air. I do not know even now why he chose the solitude. Had whoever brought him onto the Oronze already left? In films, people tear themselves away from one another weeping, and the ship separates from land, while the departed hold on to those disappearing faces until all distinction is lost. I try to imagine who the boy on the ship was. Perhaps a sense of self is not even there in his nervous stillness in the narrow bunk, in this green grasshopper or little cricket, as if he has been smuggled away accidentally, with no knowledge of the act, into the future. He woke up hearing passengers running along the corridor, so he got back into his clothes and left the cabin. Something was happening. Drunken yells filled the night, shouted down by officials. In the middle of B deck, sailors were attempting to grab hold of the harbor pilot. Having guided the ship meticulously out of the harbor, there were many routes to be avoided because of submerged wrecks and an earlier breakwater. He had gone on to have too many drinks to celebrate his achievement. Now, apparently, he simply did not wish to leave. Not just yet. Perhaps another hour or two with the ship.
Readers, I hope you enjoyed this best of 2011 and have stockpiled some titles to help you get 2012 off to a great start. Thanks so much for joining me today, and see you next week on The Book Report. I ought not have drank it, now it's much too